Time to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist. And as always the case, he comes by the first Wednesday of the month to talk with us about all things in the Wisconsin wildlife outdoors. Pretty much outdoors, if it's wildlife. Scott Craven, our guest, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're in Madison, you can reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call. Scott, welcome back. Nice to have you with us.
Good to be here on such a snowy day, at least for our southern listeners.
Yeah, the southern people up north, they don't know what's
going on down here.
But I'll tell you what, there's a lot of wind and a lot of snow.
That was about the worst conditions crossing campus I think I've experienced in my few years of doing this program.
Yeah, what, it was 50 years now, isn't
50
it?
50 years, 51.
Been a long time. No, it really is. How does that affect the wildlife, though?
Well, there's still no reports that I've heard of really things in trouble, but it's clearly been a long winter with a persistent snow cover. So I've still got to think that if this keeps on going like this, that there'll be some impacts in parts of the state on pheasants. And, people say the turkeys are pretty resilient, but bottom line is, it can't be a good thing to have a prolonged winter like this. But how detrimental it will be will remain to be seen.
Yeah. This is National Bird Feeding Month, by the way. My bird feeders are, well, I've got more squirrels than birds in there, it seems, half the time. But
did you get my invitation to the big National Bird Feeding Month party?
No, I didn't.
I must have forgotten. It is National Bird Feeding Month, and it's a good time, therefore, to remind folks to keep those feeders clean. And the birds are really using them heavily now, with all these persistent, just one snowfall after another. So keep the feeders clean. I had one fall off the deck the other day, which prompted me to actually take a critical look at it. And, oh, my God, they were just caked in seeds and all from the off-and-on rain and thawing. Those really should be scraped out, cleaned out, dipped in a weak disinfectant solution, a weak bleach solution, dried and put back up for the good of the birds. And presumably that's why most people are feeding, so keeping those feeders clean is important. And then lastly, on the subject of bird feeding, a new edition of our long-time popular bird feeding publication that's been around for about 30 years with Extension, the one entitled Bird Feeding Tips for Beginners and Veterans.
Yeah.
A new version of that will be coming out shortly, if it isn't already out, through the Extension offices and the Extension website. The publication number is G3176, and we finished the proofs a month or so ago, so I would assume it would be forthcoming shortly. A lot of good advice on what seeds to use, where to put your feeders, how to avoid pests, dealing with squirrels, all that good stuff.
Well, I tell you what, I had a little wire cage attached to the one bird feeder, and in it, the suet, and mm-hmm. something took the whole cage right off the feeder, and I thought, well, it's got to still be in the snow or something, but it must have carried it right off.
That sounds like Mr. Raccoon.
That's sure, and I saw the tracks. Mr. Raccoon was there. Well, Doug in Eau Claire has a question for you, so let's go to Doug. Hi, Doug. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, Larry, and good morning, Scott. I had a question. I'm involved with a group in Eau Claire. It's called the Chippewa Valley the Lower Chippewa Valley River Alliance, and we're working to try to bring attention to the issue of songbirds, and this is a great habitat for songbird breeding. But my real question is, while we're doing some things to try to protect songbird habitat, the looming thing that still hangs over my mind is this issue with antennas and TV antennas in particular. We have a really tall antenna in Eau Claire, and every so often they report the number of songbirds that are laying at the bottom of this, on the ground of this antenna, and during their spring and fall migration, they're hitting the stay cables and the antenna itself. And I wonder if there's been any new discussion or research done on how you can do something about that problem.
Keep them away from it or whatever. Okay.
Well, as a matter of fact, we have a master's student in the department right now working on that very issue on a number of towers around Dane County.
Cool.
Here in southern Wisconsin. And I think if you if you want to drop me an email or phone call or whatever, I can put you in touch with Emily. Her name's Emily Travis, and this is exactly what she's working on, and she's well-versed on what's been going on around the country with the issue, and I'm pretty sure she'd be happy to talk with you about it.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. So drop a note to Scott, and he will make sure that you get in touch with Emily.
Consider it done.
Consider it done. All right, let's go to Mike in Coon Valley. Hi, Mike. Thank you for calling.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
My question is concerning putting in a food plot for whitetails to try to, you know, attract more to our specific hunting area, my group, and to hold them and support them over winter.
Mm-hmm.
And for a lot of things about turnips, and both good and bad, special clovers, I was wondering, corn and soybeans, what's the ideal mix to put out there to that will take care of them year-round?
Well, the ideal mix is going to be a little bit elusive because depending on who you ask, you'll get many different opinions.
If
I wanted something out there right now, given all the snow we've had, you couldn't beat a little standing corn still on the landscape. At least for the winter, and during the warmer season, even alfalfa or some of the other clover and legume mixes are fine. But there's a lot of help available for you, Mike. Are you hooked up with the Quality Deer Management Group at all?
No, we're not.
Well, you could probably tap into their system online, but their periodic magazine entitled Quality Whitetails is filled with information on food plots for different parts of the country, you know, different types of planters you can get a hold of, seed mixes, recommendations, and so forth. And there's often, I think in the last four or five issues that I've looked at, I'm pretty sure there's been some how-to articles in there in terms of everything from soil preparation to weed control and getting your food plot up and running. In fact, if my memory is correct, and mind you, I'm old and feeble at this point, but I'm pretty sure the last issue of Field & Stream magazine, that I think was the most recent magazine I was looking at over the weekend, had a story in there called Food Plots 101, which kind of went through all the basics. And in addition, here in Wisconsin, there's an outfit in Omro. In fact, there are a couple places in the state, but Kester's Wild Game Nursery, which you can find online, Kesters, offers a variety of seed mixes for Wisconsin soil types. And I think I'm not sure they still do, but they did have a bit of a consulting service so that you could phone them up and say, hey, we're over here in Coon Valley, and this is the soil type and topography and slope and aspect we've got. What would you recommend? And then they've got the seed mixes to fit that to a T.
Oh,
so
that's very
those,
nice.
Those, I think the old seed company had seed mixes, and there's another one called Wild Game Nurseries. Where's that one? I'm trying to remember. But
Wild
in any
Game
event,
Nursery?
a little bit of Google searching, or particularly look for Kester's, hook into the Quality Deer Management Association folks, and check out the last issue of Field & Stream, and I think you'll find everything you could need. But if I had something on my land right now that I know would have some deer in it, it would be corn.
Okay.
Everything else would be buried.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890, or email us at talk@wpr.org, talking with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. And Cynthia in Madison is next. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi. This is perfect. I had something in my yard last Saturday. I'm in the city of Madison, and I could not identify it. It was in between the size of a chipmunk and a gray squirrel. And speaking of corn, I have a corn hopper in my yard, so I'm always bringing in bunnies and even the mallards recently. And it had a squirrel-shaped face, like I said, in between the size of a chipmunk and a gray squirrel. It was definitely nocturnal, and it had darting movements. It was coming out of my big old pine tree, darting down onto the ground, getting some seed, darting back up into the tree. And as near as I could tell at night, it had a light underbelly. And I'm hoping that you might have an idea of what it is.
Well, as a matter of fact, I'm pretty sure I can tell you exactly what it was. It's likely a southern flying squirrel.
Yeah. Oh, I thought, yes, and it had a tail that was kind of flat and a little bit triangular.
Big eyes.
See, you held back that vital piece of information just testing us, but it didn't work. Anyway, it's a southern flying squirrel. They have a white belly. They're kind of brownish on the back, a big rudder-like flat tail. And they move very quickly. They're strictly nocturnal. They're beautiful little animals, and they love seed feeders in the winter. So that's what you have.
I saw one fly once, and it was just in someone else's yard, and I was just, you know, screeched on the brakes and stopped. And I'm so thrilled that they're in my yard.
Well, not only are they there, but there's likely to be more than one of them. So keep your eyes open.
And keep your eyes peeled.
You can rig up a floodlight, or better yet, if they're a little nervous, a red filtered light that will allow you to watch them at night, and then eventually they'll get used to that and come right out and sit there for you.
Mm-hmm. Is there any possibility that they'll actually nest in my big old pine tree?
They probably already are.
Oh, all right.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Cynthia. Speaking of nesting and so forth, I got a little thing this morning saying Valentine's Day was the start of the breeding season for skunks, and you know, I guess this is kind of the time of the year when nature begins to take its course, and for a number of animals and wildlife.
Well, a lot of things get underway in February. Some things are already underway, but the rabbits will be breeding soon, the skunks, the foxes, and so forth. So, yes, in a normal year, things would be starting to moderate a little bit, and there'd be lots of activity. But as a sign of the times, I put up our phenology list on the door yesterday that the students report all their spring observations on, and the first entry was made yesterday, and it was a cardinal singing. I think based on today's weather, it was probably regretted the effort, but nevertheless, those things are getting underway. I don't think the skunks tune in necessarily to exactly Valentine's Day.
Oh, I doubt that.
Plus or minus a week or two, they're out there.
I think it just made for a nice little news story, a little news report from that organization. Ivan and Sullivan, it's your turn. Hi, Ivan.
Hello. Scott, I had talked with a gentleman. I had problems with my trees, with oak wilt.
Yes.
And the city of Janesville is kind of working with a gentleman down there who's an inventor, who invented a flexible sealer that goes over any cuts or anything on your trees.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do pruning or when there's damage to a tree, they paint this stuff on and it seals underneath without the problem with the oak wilt, the bugs and all that, and the birds pecking in the middle of the wound, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And as the tree grows, it grows bark underneath it, and then this rubberized stuff, it falls off, and you have bark underneath. Hmm. And I'm wondering if you had heard of it or anything like that, and, you know, what I can do to help my trees, because I'm losing them.
Well, I can't tell you much about it, Ivan. I mean, there are a number of tree wound dressings that have been around for a long time in terms of various paints and other sealants.
Most of which aren't recommended anymore, with the exception of oaks for oak wilt.
Yeah, and if in your case, you need to talk to your local forester about what else you might do, but I think there are issues of cutting and disturbance of the root systems at certain times of the year, and protecting any injuries or wounds that may occur. And if this particular rubberized product meets your needs for that, it sounds like a good thing. That's about all I can tell you about it.
And, you know, it's not a tree show, but unfortunately, if your oak trees are fairly close together, that disease can travel through the roots, as Scott was kind of implying there. And you need to really well, you could go to treeboard.org online. That's the Dane County Tree Board, and we have quite a bit of information on there on oak wilt, and you can take a look at that, treeboard.org. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Our guest today, our on-air producer, is Brittany DeAnda. I'm Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking wildlife now with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, and Margie in Chippewa Falls is up next, so let's go to Margie. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello. I love your show, by the way. I'm a wildlife enthusiast all my life, so I get a lot of joy from this program.
Thank you.
The question I have is I've been noticing little blue spots in the snow that look like, you know, when you see where a rabbit has urinated or whatever, and it's kind of reddish or yellow. I've noticed a beautiful blue spots on the snow just last year and this year, and it's mainly out where the bird feeder is and then a bit beyond that in the woods. I had called a local wildlife biologist last year. He said he's seen it, too, in a few spots, and he thought it had to do with chemical reaction in the snow or whatever. But I was wondering if it could be connected to, in the past 2 years, I've started using really premium bird seed that for songbirds, and it smells really good. And I use a lot of the black oil sunflower seeds, and it says it's got grape juice or cherry juice, and it does have fruit in it. And I was just wondering if it would be due to that from the, you know, the rabbits eating it, and then, you know, like if there's a dye in it or something.
Well, certainly if there's anything grape related, the
blueberry,
the chemical grape or blueberry or buckthorn berries or anything like that that are still around, the residue from those can create a blue or purple stain pretty easily. And the active ingredient, the chemical that gives grape flavoring, methylanthranolate, is a common bird repellent. But anyway, if there is something like that in there, and I'm not sure how you'd add grape juice or grape flavoring to a bird seed mix, but if it's in there, there are some seed mixes that have chopped fruits, and if there's anything like that there, then that certainly could be one explanation. But I've also seen the blue coloration often around my raspberry patch where the rabbits are frequenting. And I think the other fellow you talked to was on the right track, that it's got something to do with some condition related to rabbit urine.
Right. Okay.
So there are a couple of possibilities there, but I think the more likely one is the rabbit urine situation.
Thank you, Margie.
Okay. I just had one more comment. I've been having a Tom Turkey for the past 2 years, pretty much taken residence in my yard. And it isn't, we used to have like the flocks come through with the, you know, the couple of hens with all their little, you know, their brood. But this is different. This is a big, beautiful Tom. And he comes right up on my deck. He isn't aggressive because I'd read the story about Fred and Woodbury or whatever that had to be shot. So he's not like that, but he pretty much hangs out in my yard from, let's say, August till March for the past 2 years. And he's real friendly but not aggressive. And he acts like a wild bird in every respect. He goes around the yard and, you know, eats not just under the feeder, but he does eat under the feeder. And he comes up in the morning. He'll come up and look in the patio door and wait for me to come out and put out the seed, which he gets along fine with everybody else. He doesn't chase any of the birds or bunnies or squirrels. But I was just wondering, well, the other day he did the tail fanning, where he came right up to the patio door and was doing the tail fanning. It was gorgeous. He's only done that once, but I was just wondering how common this would be.
Well, it's not uncommon. Turkeys habituate to people, especially if they're getting fed, and the more they're tolerated and encouraged, the tamer they get. It's not necessarily something we, you know, we like to see amongst wild turkeys, because that behavior come third week in April when turkey season opens is not going to stand him in very good stead if he leaves your yard. There's also the possibility that it was a semi-domesticated bird to begin with, and it's only doing what comes naturally in that regard. But even truly wild birds will, we've had lots of accounts over the years of them pecking on patio windows and chasing their reflections and chasing joggers. And I caught one sitting on the top of a gas pump at a gas station here in Madison one day and had to put it in a box and take it away for them. So they do that kind of thing, but it's not what you'd call normal behavior for a normal wild gobbler.
No, it isn't. Saw a little video on the newscast the other night of a turkey pecking away at a glass, at a window, and I think it was at a gas station. It might have been at a gas station. So, but it's not the kind, as you say, it's not the kind of thing you really want to encourage. You don't want them to become tame.
Right. On the other hand, it's kind of hard to discourage, too,
if the
bird is semi-domesticated. So all you could do is remove the food and largely ignore it and hope it goes on about its business. But Margie seems to be deriving a lot of enjoyment from that turkey, so I'd leave it alone.
Leave it alone, Margie. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. And in McHenry, Illinois, We go to you now. Hi, Anne. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about some unwanted mouse guests in our house.
Okay.
Cleaning up the droppings and litter and whatnot, should I be concerned with any diseases, or what kind of precautions should I take in cleaning that stuff up?
Well, first of all, you should do what you can to rid yourself of the mice. And I'm on very thin ice at this time because I have a few mice of my own that I've not been tremendously successful at ridding, and I have a sinking feeling that my wife and daughter, who's off from school today, are probably listening. So I'm in for some grief at dinner time tonight. But first of all, get rid of the mice. And secondly, what cleanup you have to do, the older the mouse droppings, in other words, if this is been an ongoing problem for years and you're sort of getting back into cracks and crevices where droppings have accumulated, the older and drier they are, the more you need to be concerned about dust-borne or particle-borne respiratory issues. And if that were the case, at a minimum, I'd probably A, wear latex gloves, and B, wear a simple painter's mask, a simple dust mask. I don't think you need a respirator or anything like that or professional help, but take some precautions to not breathe and handle the stuff any more than you need to. Bag it up and get it out of there, and then treat the area with a light disinfectant, and that should be the end of it. But a scattered dropping here and there that's relatively fresh, wipe it up with a paper towel and wash your hands and
be
on your way.
Okay, now you said, of course, we have to get rid of the mice, and we know pretty well where the entrance way is, mm-hmm. and we're, of course, going to fix that come spring. But my concern is, any advice on not trapping them inside, how do we make sure they're all gone before we fix that entranceway?
Well, that's always a little tricky, but you can, if you've been successful at trapping them, keep up the trapping and keep checking the traps, and eventually you'll get to the point where the law of diminishing returns sets in. They'll either be no more mice, or you're down to the last one or two that may be difficult to catch. But at that point, I'd feel reasonably comfortable. If you go 2 or 3 weeks without a catch, going ahead and sealing up the opening.
Mm-hmm. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling in. The number for you to call to join in, 1-800-642-1234, or in Madison, reach us at 263-1890. John in Nelsonville is next. So let's go to John. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Scott.
Thanks for calling.
Hey, my question is a little more political than it is biological, but I was wondering, it's on the elk herd, and as far as I know, these are descendants of Michigan elk, which are Rocky Mountain elk. So we're talking that they're a non-native species to Wisconsin. And I was wondering, I'm under the impression that once we start having hunts, which actually might be sooner than later, as we thought, which is very good news, but once we start having these hunts, I'm under the impression that only Native Americans are going to be able to hunt these animals. And I'm wondering, since we use state dollars, basically DNR money and whatever other funding, federal funding they got from that, as well as the fact that they are a non-native species and they are planted, why the rest of us won't be able to hunt?
Well, I've never heard that.
I have never heard that, John. That may be one of some of these things, once they get started, and they often start in variety of places, but once these kinds of things get started, they take on a life of their own. But neither Larry nor I have heard of this. We've been following the elk issue. There might be some concession if the elk herd was on tribal land, for example. There might be some concession to a percentage of permits or whatnot going, but I don't even think that's the case. And the notion that they're a non-native species is kind of a touchy one. If we'd restricted ourselves to restoring the elk herd from Wisconsin genotypes, we'd still be at zero elk because mm-hmm. there are no such thing left. So you're right. The herd start or genesis in 1995 was 25 elk from the Pigeon River herd in the central lower portion of Michigan. And our herd has grown from that. But those animals originated as Rocky Mountain elk. But I think for most people, you're splitting hairs to go to it's still an elk. Everybody's pretty happy they're there. People will be thrilled if the herd builds to the point there could be limited bull hunting, which, as you say, is hopefully in the future. But I've not heard anything about access to those animals. I just can't imagine that would fly. I don't think that would have a chance of flying. So
I should mention that, and I don't have the date, so I sorry for that, but we will be having the DNR secretary on the show coming up in a few weeks, and could ask him directly. I've never heard a thing about
the,
that.
The restoration of the elk up around Clam Lake has been a big success story. It's a good, a feel-good thing, and I just don't think there's anything to that Native American restriction.
And thanks for calling, John. Appreciate it. We'll take some more calls here. Norm in Wausau is next, so let's go to Norm. Hi, Norm.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Thanks for calling.
Scott, I wanted to just mention something that I know will be helpful for all the people who have trouble with mice in their house.
Mm-hmm.
We've lived in this house for about 30 years, and for about 20 years, we've repetitively had mice in our attic. And during the wintertime, I would hear them at night crawling around. I'd set traps and put bait up and stuff, and it was really a grind. Well, this fall, I had a person come over, a carpenter come over. We went up into the attic for him to see where he had to put those baffles in so when they blew the insulation in, it wouldn't fill up the eave edges. And I noticed a line of maple seeds right under the ridge vent going all the way down along the attic, along the ridge, and all the meats of the maple seeds were chewed out. It was the wing part and the hull to the seed. And then it dawned on me, we went up on the roof, and, you know, under the ridge vent, they got that, like a fabric, plastic fabric to keep out bugs and stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that had been chewed out by the mice, and what had happened was they apparently come up the trees that overhang part of the house and drop down off of the limbs onto the house in the fall, chewed through that thing, and got into the house. So what we did, we had to pull all the ridge vents off, and we put down this heavy aluminum gutter guard, not the stuff that comes in a roll, but the stuff that comes in either 3 or 4 foot pieces.
Yeah.
It's fairly heavy. We nailed that down right over the slot that's cut in the ridge peak of the house, and then we put the regular ridge vent over the top of that. And, you know, this is the first year that I do not hear or see any rattling up yet.
Well, congratulations. And I would say if that seems to be someone's problem, there's a good, pretty good,
it's a good
primer
place to
on
look.
How to deal with the ridgeline vent. But unfortunately, with mice, there are so many ways and places they get in, and it only takes a hole the size of a dime. That may not be the answer for everybody.
May not be, but if you're having problems and you can't figure it out, take a look at your ridge vent. Thanks, Norm, for calling. Appreciate it very much. We'll get David from South Milwaukee on next. David, hi.
Good morning, fellas. I'm not a country boy. It's going to be pretty obvious by my question.
Okay.
I exercise in an area that is open, kind of a playground, baseball field type area.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And I think I read several years ago that the city of Milwaukee introduced hawks into the area to try and take care of pest birds. And these hawks tend to frequent this playground area. Unfortunately, here I am putzing around in their breakfast plate because there's squirrels romping around there, and periodically there are blackbird conventions on the baseball field and things. And there I am all the time, kind of scaring those birds away and the squirrels away. And so I'm a little concerned whether or not those hawks are going to think that, well, listen, I want to get rid of this guy, or,
okay.
Or there's a very big breakfast, you know, on the charts one of these mornings.
Well, I tell you what, Scott, I don't think there's a problem there.
David, I think you can continue to exercise in that park without giving any risk from hawks a second thought. Mm-hmm. That's not, it's just a non-issue. There's a bit of basis, in fact, in terms of the the restoration of peregrine falcons on some of the large buildings downtown, which do prey on other birds. But the kind of hawks that might be foraging, especially at this time of year, on a mouse or a squirrel out in the playground are not peregrines. It might be a passing red tail or rough leg hawk that the city of Milwaukee had nothing whatsoever to do with, and they would have no interest in you whatsoever. Absolutely none. So don't worry. Continue to exercise and enjoy what you see, but don't worry about the threat.
Now, there is one situation where it can become a problem.
Well, there is later on. Yeah, we should qualify. if later on in the year, if you're out in the wide open spaces, you're probably in the clear. But if you get near a green space or a tree line or whatnot, and there happen to be a pair of Cooper's hawks nesting in that area, then those adults can become very territorial and actually swoop down and appear fairly threatening. So I'm glad you remembered that, Larry. That's one circumstance. You're not likely to run into it, but it's one circumstance where a hawk might make a threatening gesture.
And I did, and the reason I remembered it was there was one on a local golf course last year, and, you know, flew by and flew at some golfers, and I don't think anybody got hit. But that's the situation. You're safe, Dave. Thanks for calling. Vince in Watertown, it's your turn. Hi, Vince.
Hello. I'm not an outdoors person, but I have a less serious story here to tell you and maybe get a little bit of a feel about what's really going on. One day I came home. I live in Watertown on Silver Creek, and we have turkeys in our backyard, and we have a gazing ball on a pedestal. And this turkey came by, went to the gazing ball, started walking around it, started pecking at it, and then a couple of days later, he came over with the whole flock, went to the gazing ball, started picking at it, became very, my wife saw this, and then I saw it a couple of days later. He became very amorous with the gazing ball in a narcissistic kind of a way, and then the other ones followed. But this has been going on now for about 3 weeks, and he keeps coming back to the gazing ball, and he goes through the same routine every day. It's really funny.
It sounds pretty funny to watch. You should take some digital pictures if you can and submit them to the local newspaper or outdoor program or something. They would probably enjoy using them. But that's one of the things we've found over the years on the program, that their wildlife eventually do all sorts of interesting and strange things, and people enjoy seeing them. So keep up the good work, Vince.
Well, I really enjoy listening to you guys, and I had to call in with that story.
That's a great that's a great story. The gazing ball. The bell of the ball is the gazing ball.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I tell you what. You know, I didn't ask you. Well, let's see. Let's go to Ron in Sparta.
Okay.
Ron, let's hear what you've got to say. Hi.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. They had on the news either late yesterday or this morning about the cougar tracks in Rock County and the urine specimens that were taken to see the where the species came from, and then they even indicated that there were a pair of cougars trapped in Wisconsin approximately 5 years ago. I live in Monroe County. My brother lives in around Hillsboro, and they saw a pair of cougars, black cougars or black panthers, approximately 5 years ago. I was wondering if those were the ones that were trapped.
Well, let's sort things out here a bit, Ron. First of all, I know nothing about any cougars being trapped in Wisconsin in many, many, many years. So I don't think there's anything to that rumor that you heard at all. Now, as far as the cougar down in Rock County near Milton, that's been getting a lot of publicity. An individual saw the animal or found the tracks, tracked it into an old barn, confronted the animal. The animal fled through a hole in the side of the barn, hasn't been seen since. But he reported it, and the DNR folks investigated it. And unlike a lot of these sightings, there were excellent tracks in the snow. They followed those tracks, measured them, photographed them, and in the course of following the tracks, found not only a urine sample, but a drop of blood. And ultimately, I think it was the drop of blood that gave up the genetic evidence that confirmed that it was, in fact, a cougar, although the tracks were sent all over the place by email, and lots of folks around the country with a great deal of cougar experience confirmed that they were cougar tracks. But the genetic evidence, you know, for those of us who are CSI fans, you know, you got to have DNA evidence these days. And that in fact, confirmed that it was a cougar. And they've gone on to say that this is really the first definitive proof of a cougar in many years. But in reality, there have been many, many other sightings, too many to dismiss, too many by people who know what they're doing. In fact, I got in Monday morning. I've been part of the email string on this particular animal. But I get in on Monday morning, had a call from a longtime listener in Rhinelander to the program who had worked at one of our nature centers that has a pair of cougars and had worked with the cougars, so he knew what he was looking at. And he saw one over the weekend about a few miles east of Rhinelander on Highway 8, and he stopped and it stood there and looked at him, and he got a very good look at it. So there are clearly other sightings around the state, but we just haven't had either the specimen or the DNA evidence or confirmed tracks or photographs or whatnot to document it. And it's been hard to separate some of the sightings from hoaxes that have circulated on the internet repeatedly. But the bottom line is, now we have confirmation that what they're waiting for is further evidence from the DNA sample that might suggest the likelihood that this animal was, in fact, a released or escaped captive, as opposed to a truly wild animal that may have wandered into Wisconsin from who knows where. But, of course, that begs the question now, is where the heck is it? Because there's been no sign of it since that original encounter. And they're large, mobile animals. They can cover a lot of ground. It could be a long, long way from Rock County right now. Or it could be holed up there, staying out of harm's way. So the good news here is we have confirmation. All the folks who have called the program for the last 20 years with cougar sightings can now feel, aha, I told you so. You know, I did see one. We've never really doubted that. But the question remains, and still remains on this animal too, where the heck did it come from? And is it a sign of a it's not a remnant population, but is it a sign that cougars have reestablished themselves in Wisconsin in any numbers, and whether they're reproducing? And my colleagues are up in Wausau as we speak right now at the state chapter of the Wildlife Society meeting, and a cougar working group is forming of interested agency and other folks. They're obviously taking this seriously, giving it some attention, developing a plan on how to deal with these animals as they potentially become more abundant or more visible. So the mystery and all that has surrounded this for so many years, I think, is over, and I welcome that with open arms.
With open arms.
With open arms.
It gives you a little bit of a start to go walking into a building like that, and then a big cat comes jumping down.
It would certainly get your attention. I mean, they are big, and it'll be interesting to see where this all goes and what other evidence turns up, and maybe they'll find this animal again, maybe they won't. But yeah. I'm pretty sure there are others around.
Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. And Scott, I tell you what, we've got a kind of a fun event coming up this weekend, and I'm going to be participating. Are you going to be participating too?
I will be participating as an attendee, but I'm not offering any programs this year.
Okay.
And, what's at stake here is the Garden Expo, which has become a big and very popular event at the Alliant Energy Center grounds on the south side of Madison. It's the 8th, 9th, and 10th. And the wildlife relevance here is that it'll get people outdoors thinking about spring gardening and planting. And, of course, when you start thinking about spring gardening and planting, you know, please think about using plant materials that are wildlife-friendly, that will provide food or cover that birds and other wildlife can use. Think about a food plot. Think about things that may persist into next winter. Take wildlife into account when you think about your landscaping needs and gardening plans, not only to benefit them, but also think about the things you may do to prevent problems with wildlife around the home or problems with wildlife getting into your gardens. And both those aspects will be covered at some of the displays and educational programs at the Garden Expo. But I'll tell you, after the way the weather's been the last couple of months, I'm ready to just stand around in there and look at some flowers. So
it's a great place. I'll be there Saturday from 11 to noon. Shelley Ryan and I will be answering. Well, Shelley will be answering most of the gardening questions. But anyway, we always have a nice group of people for that. And we won't be talking wildlife much, although we may be talking about some plants to attract wildlife. But certainly we'll be answering gardeners' questions from 11 to noon. And that's this coming weekend. So it should be a lot of fun. And Gene in Sand Creek has a question for you, Scott. So let's go to Gene. Hi, Gene.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I enjoy your program.
Thank you.
I live in the country, and our house is surrounded by trees, and I was walking out to the mailbox yesterday. I heard a phoebe singing.
Oh.
Wow.
Now, it's early, isn't it, for them?
Well, yes, it is. But even in spite of how wintry this winter seems to have been, we've been getting lots of reports of robins around, of bluebirds around, and now a phoebe. Mm-hmm. You know, strange.
North of Eau Claire.
Yeah, strange. Well, I was going to ask you where Sand Creek was. I get around the state a bit, but I don't believe I've ever been in Sand Creek.
South of Chautauqua.
Uh-huh. Okay. All well, right. In any event, it is up there a ways, and
yes.
It is early, but
what?
I'm not sure where to go with this.
Yeah. I just wanted to tell you, I heard the phoebe singing.
Well,
spring must be on its way.
I would hope so, but
it
is definitely early. But
but
strange things happen, and that's again what keeps it interesting.
Right. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it.
Have you been to Sand Creek?
I have been by Sand Creek.
Uh-huh.
I've been near Sand Creek.
Okay.
I wanted to go back and just on the Garden Expo. It is February 8th, 9th, and 10th, and it's at the Alliant Energy Center in Madison, just to sort of repeat and make sure everybody knows when and where. Mike in Eastman is up next. Hi, Mike. Thank you for calling.
Yes, good morning. I have a question with all the tracking and research on wolf population. Are there any information on that being in southwest Wisconsin? I've discovered some very unusually large tracks, much larger than coyote, and they're usually on a deer trail mixed with the deer tracks. And I even had some near my house,
mm-hmm.
which is surrounded by the woods, you know.
Yeah. Well, the short answer to your question is, Mike, I can't speak to this specific case, but if you get good samples of large tracks, you know, tracks that are 3.5-4 inches or better in size, and can take a picture of those with a ruler laid next to them or something like that, if you get good quality tracks, then it's easy enough to email those in, and the folks who know wolves can make a call for you. But in a general sense, my answer would be there's not, given the mobility of wolves, their general range, and the number of wolves we have in the state now, there isn't a corner of the state from north to south or east or west where it would shock me in any way to think that a wolf had passed through. You know, maybe setting up residence and hanging around is a different story, but I think there's the potential for people to encounter either sign or the animals virtually anywhere. So,
the population.
What is the population?
Where?
Oh, well, the stronghold of the population is, of course, about the northern third of the state, but they move downward kind of in west central Wisconsin into Jackson Adams County area, that kind of thing north. But the stronghold, the bulk of the packs, are still the northern third of the state. But marked animals have turned up all over the place, not just in Wisconsin, but remember the one a few years ago we talked about that was a marked Wisconsin animal that was found dead in a soybean field in eastern Indiana, almost to the Ohio line. So that gives you some idea of the kind of ground they can cover. And there have been road kills in Dane County here, over by Milwaukee, all over the place. So they can get around is the issue. Mm-hmm. And the population mostly north and around 550 animals now, give or take a few.
Thanks, Mike, for calling. Appreciate it. Dave in Augusta, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Dave.
Hello. I just drove through Sand Creek about 10 minutes ago.
Is it snowing in Sand Creek?
No, but there's about probably 7 or 8 inches of snow on the ground. That's a real nice little town. My question regards squirrels. I've got a nesting pair, or had a nesting pair of what I've always called fox squirrels.
Mm-hmm.
They're the reddish orange colored squirrel. One got hit by a car here a few weeks ago, and there's just one left that I know of, sitting in the tree all by itself, of course, looking lonely. What are the chances of that starting a family with the Wisconsin gray squirrel? I mean, does that happen?
Two different species of animals. So, you know, there are occasional hybrids in nature, but not likely. But, you know, fox squirrels aren't all that scarce. I think there's a better probability that the surviving pair member is going to turn up with another fox squirrel at some point, and everyone will live happily ever after.
Oh. All right. Thanks, Dave. Thanks for calling. Yep. And typically, if one squirrel dies, there's another one there to take its place.
Well, there isn't much of a family unit or pair bond as far as squirrels are concerned to begin with. So
yeah.
I think another fox squirrel will arrive on the scene.
Let's go to Steve in Stoughton next. Hi, Steve.
Hey, good morning, guys. I live on the Yahara River just south of Lake Iganza, and we've been watching across the river. Some beaver have been active on some trees, and we've had trees taken down, the cottonwood mostly, but I noticed there's a couple oak trees they've taken down, and I was kind of surprised by that, and I was wondering, is that normal or not?
Well, they certainly have preferred trees that they're more interested in, willows and aspen and cottonwood and things like that, but they've certainly taken down oaks and will take down oaks in a different setting, whether they're interested in food or just the branches or they're using them for a lodge or a dam or whatever. I'm not sure what their motivation is, but an oak, of course, is a tougher job for a beaver, even with their impressive dentition. A softwood like a willow or a cottonwood is a much easier proposition than taking down an oak, but
yep.
they will do it.
Yep.
Neighbor across the street is a little, or across the river is a little upset by that.
I would think so. And you know, if beavers on private land, although they're fascinating animals and fun to watch and all that, can be fairly destructive. And the regulations on dealing with nuisance beaver are very much liberalized in a landowner's favor. So if the tree issues become intolerable, there are certainly things you can do to get them removed.
Okay.
He already indicated that he would be doing that.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. Thanks a lot for calling. 1-800-642-1234, the number to call for you to join in. Let's go to Judy and Ripon next. Hi, Judy. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm going to squeak a quick one in here. I was wondering, what time of year do you start putting out plates of jelly and oranges and that for the Orioles? Because I realize it's only February, but I'm wondering, what's the earliest point I can do that? That was my first question. The second part is, how high up can I put food for Orioles and songbirds? How high will they fly to a feeder? Because I've got a balcony outside of my bedroom, and I thought it'd be so cool. It's about 20 feet up. If I could put some out there, and would they come up that high?
They will go a lot higher than you want to put any jelly, I can assure you.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't worry about that at all. If you've got a spot up on a second or third level where you can place a feeder that they will see and find, they'll use it. So I wouldn't worry about that, although I might work your way up there with one or more other feeders moving the placement so they get used to going higher and have
cool.
a better chance of finding it, especially if it's close to the building. As far as when to put it up, that's going to be dictated entirely by the phenology of the spring. I mean, wait until spring has sprung. Snow's gone. It's warmed up. We're starting to see some migrant birds. I mean, the red wings will have to be back. Those will be among the first birds. So I think you're well into April. And,
okay.
I mean, I don't put – Larry, no. When do you put things up? I'm thinking mid to late April probably.
Yeah.
Something
probably
like
usually
that.
Usually around late April.
So, you know, keep your eyes open. Certainly if you see any birds, see any Orioles, then it's time to get it up. But otherwise, when bird migration's in full swing, it can't hurt to put it out because there are other species that will use it even before the Orioles get here.
Oh, it's snowing like the dickens here right now, and I want you to know I traipsed through a good foot of snow all the way out to my bird feeder because you said it's time now to make sure you clean those out, and I did that.
Commendable. Very good.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks, Judy. Thanks a lot for calling. All right. Somebody take your advice. That's good. That's a very good thing.
It happens every once in a while.
Bob in Darlington has a question for you. Oh, hold on a second here. I did something that I shouldn't have done. Let me just see here. Oh, there. Now we can get Bob in Darlington.
Yeah,
hi,
hello.
Bob.
Thanks a lot for taking my call, Larry. And good morning, Scott.
Good morning.
And I'd like to talk about two animals that my wife and I think highly of. And the first one is a bat, and the other one's a cat.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of bats in Darlington.
Mm-hmm.
And, boy, we don't have too many insects around, so we love this little bat then, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we do. And I bought a bat conservatory for my son, who's got a little cabin up on in between Eagle River and Sugar Camp.
Mm-hmm.
On Lake Columbus, and then he also has another little cabin on Long Lake. There's small little lakes, quite filled with nice panfish. But anyway, the fellow that called a while ago and said he had all kinds of mice in his house,
mm-hmm.
I think that if he'd get a cat like we have a little Scruffy here, I don't think he'd have any problem. What do you think?
Well, I mean, certainly a household cat is a good mouser, and that's what they do. They're very effective hunters, and kept indoors, they'll help keep your indoor mice down.
We don't have any. The last few years, we've had none.
Well, yeah. That's a good testimonial. And as far as the bats are concerned, on the other side, bats are still riding a crest of positive public relations. And I just don't hear many of the expressions of fear and loathing for bats that we used to hear. And most of the myths about them getting into people's hair or being rabid have been debunked. And people are putting up bat houses and conservatories and so forth. And that's a good thing.
It is a good thing. Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network. Talking the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Thanks for listening in. If you have a question, give us a call at 800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. And, Scott, you know, turkeys are on everybody's mind. A lot of people, several thousands of people.
I can't stop thinking about them.
Several thousands of people in the last week or so have gotten a little postcard in the mail saying, you have a chance to hunt turkeys this spring.
Yes, the folks who applied for turkey permits for the upcoming spring season, that series of five-day hunting periods starting in mid-April, were notified in the last few days, 152,000 of them, give or take a few. And that's good news for the people who got a card. The good news for the folks who didn't get a card, either because they weren't drawn or forgot to apply or whatever, the really good news there is that there are 56,000 roughly additional permits, which will go on sale at 10 o'clock in the morning on March 28th at service centers and online. And anybody, even people who've already received a permit, are eligible to buy additional permits out of that 56,000 if they're in areas and times that they can use at the rate of one a day until they're all gone at a cost of $10 apiece. So there's a second chance, but the good news is turkey permits are out, and you got one, and I got
one. I did.
And that's even better news. So there are a lot of turkeys out there, and you know, unless something again goes haywire with this winter weather, it should be another great season. The flock has been in great shape. The fall harvest last year was almost 12,000 birds, which was a little down from 06, but not very much. And hunters and anybody interested in turkeys should realize that next fall, not this spring, but next fall will bring huge changes in the way this turkey hunting zone alignment is done, and they'll be moving from many small zones to, I think, just seven large ones that encompass the whole state. So
make life a lot easier.
It will make things a lot easier. So that's also, I think, a step in the right direction. So lots of people now looking forward to sitting on a nice spring morning calling turkeys.
Yeah. And
sounds good to me.
Yeah, sounds really good to me, too. Marie in Watertown has a different kind of question, though, so let's go to Marie. Hi, Marie.
Hi. Thank you, Larry and Scott, for your nice program. I have a suggestion on how to thwart the efforts of pesky squirrels at your bird feeder by a slinky.
A slinky?
Mm-hmm.
And how do you employ this slinky?
Well, that's a good question. You cut it at one end,
mm-hmm.
thread it down the pole to the ground,
mm-hmm.
secure it at the top of the pole, use a bar hook of some kind at the bottom, pushed into the soil. And just wait and watch for the squirrels. And I am here to tell you that for $1.49, we have...
You've had thousands of dollars worth of entertainment.
Well, they go to the hilarious and still get bumped off it. But I'm telling you, this is a squirrel proofer. At first, the squirrels would maybe make an attempt to get up the pole. And finally, they would come and look at the bottom, at the hook and the soil, and look up. They don't even bother to come around and look anymore. They are thwarted.
So do the rings of the slinky collect at the bottom, or are they? Is it loose at the top?
It's stretched.
It's stretched. You can see it pulled apart.
Okay.
All the way from the top down to the bottom. But if you just split one end of that slinky, it will. You can thread it down the main pole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then secure the slinky at the top and put that some kind of hook into the soil. And you're in free.
Sounds pretty devious, but it sounds like it works. So that's a good tip. Thank you.
It works.
Okay.
Well, I got to tell you, Marie, it won't work in my at my place because my neighbors, when they took out their pier, they sort of collected it next to our fence.
Oh, so they jump off that.
So they jump, they climb up the leg of a pier, and they sit on this little platform of which is the bottom of the leg, and all of the legs have little platforms to keep the legs from going deep into the sand, and they perch on that, and they've got about, I'd say, 10, 12-foot jump to the very point. The top is the only place they can actually land of the bird feeder, and some of those squirrels they can do it every time. Some will fall, but they'll keep trying.
Have you thought about a sheet metal cone on top of the feeder that they would hit and then just immediately slide off?
A sheet metal cone, that might work.
Yeah, that's what's used on top of poles and posts to deter, you know, roosting seagulls and things like that. And if they hit the sheet metal, they couldn't hang on, so they'd slide off, and they wouldn't want to jump on the point of it. But you could blunt that a little bit so you don't actually injure them, depending on your intentions. But I think a sheet metal cone might be the
trick, because I have to take the top off.
Yeah.
To get the feed in, though, that's the situation. So, but
well,
the cone
could just sit there. It wouldn't even have to be fastened.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Well, I'm glad I had you on the show today, Scott.
Could be hours of enjoyment for you, Larry.
I'm going to try that. And next month, I will report to you on the results. Let's go to Don in Warren, Illinois. Don, hello.
Hi, guys. I have a story, and you have to settle an argument. I was disking field farming, and I made the outside round, and it loosens the soil, and the birds come down and pick up all the bugs. Well, there were two crows came and landed and in the field and started picking. And a rabbit came out of the fence line and just hopping very deliberately, not very fast, but continuously, and went toward the crows, and they flew up. Then one of them flew away, and the other one went over 6 or 8 feet and sat down like he was going to pick again and eat, and the rabbit circled and went toward him, and this went over and over, and it caught me funny. I stopped the tractor, and I laughed till the pointer fell off, and it kept going on, and every time that crow would jump up and fly over, that rabbit would circle, come back, and head right toward him. And just before he got to the crow would fly up and settle down. And the crow never had time to eat. And I had to deduce that they were just having fun. They were just there seemed to be no other purpose than enjoying themselves.
Well, I can't disagree with your assessment. I can't think of any other logical explanation. So maybe they were just having a good time. But did this all take place in a small area of the field, or did the crow move around a bit?
He was all in the size of a room. He kept it all in the same area. They kept close to the fence line because I don't think the rabbit on bare ground like that would leave cover for any length of time. And he felt secure that he was only 5 or 6 hops from cover.
What time of year was this?
That was in the spring.
In the spring, and what was in the field when you were disking?
I had corn stalks, and I was disking down the corn stalks.
Well, you know, I'm suspicious that that rabbit didn't have a nest of young ones out there somewhere in that area, and they don't stay with the young ones. The young ones stay in the form, which could have easily been in the corn stubble, and they only visit them and nurse them at night. It's possible that the rabbit's interpretation was that the crow was looking askance at those young rabbits. And the rabbit was doing what it could to drive that crow off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there seemed to be no maliciousness in the rabbits.
It's hard for a rabbit to look malicious, though.
<You're right>. I'd like to think they were just playing, but I have a suspicion that the crow's intentions were less than honorable. So
yeah, I don't think I've seen too many killer rabbits.
So we'll probably never know, but let's go with your impression that they were just having a good time.
Okay, the argument was the wolves moving in, and we're down in Joe Davis County, just south of Grant, and it's pretty rough country over along Mississippi, and be good territory for wolves. And I told my dentist, I said, you know, we need wolves around here to rebalance the ecosystem. And he said, oh, no, they would decimate our deer and turkey population. And I said, no, I don't think so. I said, there are jillions of raccoon. And, you know, it's nothing to go hunting and get five in one tree. They could catch raccoon any time. I said, I don't think they'd eat them. Would they, in your opinion, would they take a raccoon easy rather than running down a deer?
Sure. I mean, a wolf is fairly opportunistic if they can catch a beaver or a raccoon or whatever else they can get a hold of. That's easy pickings. And in most cases, in an area like southwestern Wisconsin or over around Galena where you are, you know, there's not the persistent snow cover that's going to allow wolves to run down deer. They're more interested or going to do much better if they were in the area with road-killed carcasses or carrion left from the deer season or what have you. So I'm not sure deer would necessarily be a major part of their diet anyway.
Yeah. Anyway. Mm-hmm. So you should tell your dentist to listen to Wisconsin Public Radio the first Wednesday of every month from 11 to 12:30, and Scott can tell him the real facts.
Not to mention, Dan, the notion that, as you pointed out, deer are quite abundant and wolves are not. Even if you just did the numbers of all the wolves that are in Wisconsin right now, they just don't have the capacity to make a huge dent in our deer herd. Maybe in a local area where there are a couple packs in a relatively small area, you might notice some change. But overall, the numbers just don't add up.
Which would, 500 wolves would take how many deer in a year? 1,500?
Well, I think the statistics suggest that if wolves ate nothing other than deer, it would take the equivalent of 17 or 18 deer to sustain a wolf over an entire year. Oh. So 500 wolves times 20, what are we talking, 10,000 deer? Something like that? Is that the right number? 500 times a prescription. Yeah, 10,000.
10,000.
And, I mean, we squish five times that many on the highways, so
yeah,
the numbers aren't there.
Thanks, Don.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Al in Ozaukee County is next. Let's go to Al. Hi, Al.
Hello.
Hello. What can we do for you?
Okay, I live in south of Grafton.
Yeah.
And there was about 3 inches of snow on the ground. And it was snowing very large flakes. And I was standing by the window watching my wife on a computer. And what walks past the window here is I thought it was a dog at first, but a very large fox. Now, I mean coyote. But I never saw a coyote this big. And the unusual part was that the back and rump and everything was pretty much slate gray, and its undersides and legs went to the natural tannish color. And I thought, hey, I got to get my camera and take a picture of this guy. Well, I figured by the time I got back, he'd be gone. But I did it anyway. He was gone, and while we were standing there just remarking about how amazing this was, here comes another one. Only this one is in a golden phase. And same size, longer legged than my dog, which was 70 pounds, like I say. And the tracks of these animals were bigger. Now, have there ever been any wolf sightings or coyotes with a gray phase or an orange phase?
Well, there's a fair bit of variation in the coloration of most of the canids, especially wolves, but and to a lesser degree coyotes. But I just had a couple of digital photographs sent in yesterday of a couple coyotes in a yard south of you in Racine that were very much slate gray and dark, but coyotes, as near as I could tell. If the tracks were very large, you know, again, as we talked about with one of the earlier callers, it's not unheard of for wolves to move cross-country long distances, and there have certainly been road kills, as we mentioned, in Jefferson County outside Milwaukee, and so on. So I'm not sure I wish you'd gotten the picture, Al, but in the absence of the absence,
one interesting fact was, okay, this second one came by, oh, maybe 3, 4, 5 minutes later, and it laid down in the neighbor's yard up on a hill in back of a spruce tree, and we could see it. I did get a picture of it, but it's so small, and I didn't have a close-up, so it was really undistinguishable.
Yeah.
But have there ever been any wolf sightings in this area?
Well, as I just said, I can't speak specifically for the Grafton area, but there have been road-killed individuals south of you and north of you, and the animals are fully capable of covering hundreds of miles of terrain. So I would never rule out the possibility. But without a picture or some measurements of tracks and so forth, it's hard to tell. And in the field, a coyote or a wolf, regardless of color phase, is not necessarily an easy call to make in terms of distinguishing them, which is the reason why coyote season is closed during the fall in the northern part of the state so that wolves aren't killed by mistaken identity. So I'm not sure what you saw, Al, but it could have been. We can't rule anything out.
And thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Mary in La Crosse, I think, is next. Mary, hi to you.
Hi there. Love talking to you guys. Sunday afternoon, I was visiting my friend in West Salem, and we were sitting by the patio door eating, and she has a wooden deck and feeds birds, and there's all tons of bird food out there. And there's also a field behind her house, and she said, I hope my little pet rat comes out. And eventually he did. But he was different from the barn rats that I was used to. He was perhaps a tiny bit smaller, and he was a more pale gray, and I believe he had a little bit of white underneath his chest area. And I was wondering, I really do need to get a good ID book about wildlife in Wisconsin, and so if you recommend one. But also, do we have different kind of rats?
If it really looked like a mouse or rat, it looked like a rodent and it had a long, not very hairy tail.
Right.
There certainly are many types and an abundance of field mice, white-footed mice and deer mice that look rodent or rat-like, and a large adult could, I suppose, look like a small rat, but they do have a white belly and a grayish back.
He was definitely rat size, and we were within 5 feet of him, and we could sit and watch him. And so he was, the white-footed mouse, I know what they are, but he was definitely rat size. I thought maybe a little bit smaller than the black barn rats.
And it had a rat tail.
Definitely had a rat tail, okay. The little rat head,
well,
little beady eyes.
A rat is a rat.
Might have been smaller. Maybe it's a young rat.
You know, it could have been a younger rat, and there's variation in color. They're not all necessarily, as you describe, barn rat color. If you had a big bag of rats, there'd be quite a bit of variation from one to another, and I've seen some that are quite brownish, quite grayish, and some that have more of a differentiation between the belly color and the back color. So I'm going to have to assume from what you described, primarily because of the tail, that you saw a rat, and whether it was abnormally colored or whether it was possibly even had origins with a tame rat that someone let go, booted outside, released or whatever, that's also a possibility, although it appears that you just saw a wild rat.
And the book,
the book issue. First of all, that's a good question. And I think everybody who listens and is interested in trying to identify things should have a set of field guides. I like the Peterson field guides, but there are many other good ones. Pick whatever you like or can find or can get a good price on. But a field guide to mammals, a field guide to birds, a field guide to reptiles and amphibians. And then as far as interpreting all this other stuff, the tracks and the chew marks and the droppings, the best book is one by a fellow named Mark Elbrock, E-L-B-R-O-C-H, and it's called Mammal, Tracks, and Sign. It's a terrific book for interpreting that kind of thing. He has another one on bird tracks and signs, and another one on animal skulls, if that interests you. So those books in conjunction with a field guide to identify the critters, and you'll be home free.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot for calling. Pete in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Pete.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
Hey, I had a little tip here on the whole squirrel bird feeder dilemma. And, you know, I've tried many of the squirrel baffles that are out there, which sort of baffled me by their ineffectiveness, actually. But the one thing I have found that worked, and it was a tip I got at Chickadee Depot in Madison, is cayenne pepper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's because, you know, as you both probably know, that birds don't actually have taste buds that react to the cayenne, but it worked amazing because we had three squirrels that we could identify pretty clearly. One had a stunted tail, one had a white stripe, and one had a different kind of ear. And we saw all three of them go up there, take a bite, come down. They started shaking their heads and freaking out. They left and they didn't come back. So it really did work very effectively.
Yeah, there's even commercial formulation called Squirrel Scram that is based on either hot pepper sauce or cayenne, and it does the same thing. And the reason it works is what you just described. If that's the way you want to go, it does have some merit, as you just suggested. I'm a little reluctant to deal with any additives to the food stuff, you know, just in case this adverse effect on the birds for whatever reason or even reasons we don't understand. But if you get to that point, then it does have some merit. So
it is kind of satisfying.
Yes. It kind of gives them some of their own medicine, so to speak.
Gives them a little of their own medicine. Well, here we are, just about out of time. Jerry in Whitewater saw some crows taking a dust bath in the snow. Is that something common that you see?
That's interesting. Well, dust is hard to come by now, so it's the only game in town, I guess, if you want to get cleaned up. I've not seen that behavior, but who knows what they're up to.
Yeah, who knows what they're up to. And lots of bald eagles out there right now.
Yes, it's good viewing along the river. I think the inventory early last month in January suggested some 300 along the lower Wisconsin River. So
yeah.
Good time to head over there around Prairie du Sac and check them out.
And keep those clean those bird feeders out and keep them filled.
You can wait until the storm subsides a little bit. You don't have to go out through the snow.
Scott, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much. And you'll be back the first Wednesday of
March.
Yep. Things are going to be, hopefully, much nicer in Wisconsin than they are today.
I hope so.
I hope so, too. And thanks, everybody who called in today. And thank you very much for listening. I really appreciate it. I really appreciate all the great calls. And we'll look forward to another visit from Scott coming up the first Wednesday of next month. Just to let you know, tomorrow, David Knutson of Wisconsin Indian Head Technical College in Ashland will be our guest, and we'll be talking recipes, and we have some celebrity recipes, including one from Professor Scott Craven that we'll be offering up for you tomorrow on the program. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.